Welcome, with scotch in hand, or a glass of scotch in hand, I welcome you to Jaded Gamercast. My name is Lang, with me as always is Nathan, and amazingly enough, this is podcast 11, for God's sakes, so are you even remotely surprised that we're in the double digits right now, Nathan?
Yeah, because I think I remember we you know, episode one, we really wanted to rag on the ETC, which is what kind of spawned this.
Mm-hmm.
And then episode two is like, yay, Dark Eldar. And then episode three, we're like, God, what the fuck are we going to talk about? Who wants to listen to this?
We did hit the wall relatively quickly. It was a formidable enemy. But no, for the most part, it was just kind of like we had these great ideas and we started doing the podcast with this kind of great idea where it's just like, man, we can bitch about this shit for like an hour, 2 hours if we try really hard, you know, and we had two other things that we knew we could podcast about, but kind of after you do one or two, you start realizing, like, that's not going to fill a show, you know? you and I mostly are just like, yeah, that's stupid. It is stupid. So, how's your wife, by the way? She's still walking fronting from that game we had? Oh, she's not here to defend herself. Anyways,
and I'm not there to slap you in the face.
That's true. That's true. You can't defend
you are
her
braver
honor.
When I am further away.
I showed no fear even when you were here in the studio. But yes, welcome. Thanks for tuning in. We would like to thank everybody who's been following the podcast with I would say surprising enjoyment. People have been very positive about it, so I just wanted to throw out a big thank you for everyone who's provided feedback and sent us emails and, you know, been very honest with their feedback as well. And I think that's what makes for a good podcast. But anyways, enough of my blubbering. Nathan, I'm not letting you off easy. What are you drinking?
I'm drinking wine again. It's pretty much the only thing I have in the house right now.
Yeah, see, I'm into the scotch. I've got it's like a 17-year-old Lagavulin, so I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
You know, I'm surprised you still use glasses. By the time we hit episode 20, if we do, you'll probably just be swigging out of the bottle.
It's always a possibility, but I don't want to turn into Matt.
Hypnotic straight from the bottle.
Oh, Jesus. No, I don't want to turn it into Matt. But anyways, let's go ahead and get the show started here. Enough bullshit. Let's kick right into Higher Learning. Nathan, I'll let you take it away. Because you had right. Something special for us, I heard.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a special 3-for-1 Higher Learning this episode, because for those of you that may have cracked our Da Vinci Code, we have been trying to do alphabetical order for, you know, alternating between fantasy and 40K. Now, keep in mind, we drink a lot, so our alphabet is not that great. But that kind of did lead us into the letter D, and so we wanted to do a 3-for-1 of, you know, 40K armies who all start with the letter D. So we're going to start off with Dark Angels, and for Higher Learning on Dark Angels, Lang, what do we have to say?
Oh, listen to episode 9.
Yeah, basically. I mean, come on.
I'm not going to repeat the same shit about a stupid army
that wears bathrobes.
Yeah, I mean, what are we going to do? Reiterate the same jokes? We never do that. We're completely original on every podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nothing. Hi, Mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing repeats. all right, so that brings us to our second one of Dark Eldar. And Lang, over to you. What do you say about the Dark Eldar?
Episode 2. Listen to episode 2.
Yeah, you know, hey, look, we get we're copping out for the person that thinks this is funny.
That's exactly it. I was going to go ahead and say, it was just like, you know, this seemed like it was going to be a riot when we were talking about it. Now that we're actually doing it, it just seems like we're being a fucking idiot. Everyone's just like, yeah, we get it the first time. We have to open their mouths. They're just like, move on. So what are we really doing Higher Learning about, Nathan?
We're really actually going to do Higher Learning about Demon Hunters today, because
Demon Hunters.
You know, one of the few remaining third edition codexes in a fifth edition game.
I love them.
And also rumored to be getting a new codex sometime eventually. I mean, they feel like Dark Eldar at that point.
Well,
everybody, Grey Knights are coming out. We promise.
Well, you know, like, we heard so many rumors about the Demon Hunters. I mean, there was supposed to be an Alien Hunters codex that was supposed to come out after they came out with Witch Hunters that never came to light. And then they started saying, well, actually, no, we're going to wait and we're going to just do an Inquisition codex where we're just going to merge all three of the Ordos together. so that you're going to have, you know, options for units of Sisters, options for units of Grey Knights, options for units of Death Watch, and you can kind of play that game, you know, and kind of have them be that mishmash Marine army where everything is still Marine, but they're overpriced and very, very specialized. And hey, don't get me wrong. I mean, one of the things that's kind of been going through my mind lately is people have been really ragging on these high point cost units, you know, saying that they're just not worth the points. I mean, there's always going to be that points economy argument of, you know, like, why would you take Blood Knights when you can take, you know, four units of skeletons at the same price? They're four units of skeletons always does better, you know? And I think that there are always people who are going to argue that mentality that, well, why would you take Grey Knights? I mean, they cost this much and they only do this much damage. You're better off taking Terminators and blah, 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 right? So for me, I love the army. I love that uber specialized, uber high points cost army, because I feel like, you know, those are the ones that are really fun to play and they're so deeply embedded in the fluff. It's like you get those cinematic moments where your army just overcomes adversity and wins the game, but most of the time you're losing. Hey, I love Inquisitors. I've got like Inquisitor model that I converted up that I absolutely adore. You know, like I pondered doing Grey Knights for the longest time instead of doing my Marines.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing is just like, you know, Grey Knights, unfortunately, you know, because really when you look at the Demon Hunters book, I'm gonna back up a step. When you look at the Demon Hunters book, you intrinsically have two different elements there. You have the Inquisition elements, which is Inquisitors, Assassins, Stormtroopers, the absolutely badass Demon Hosts, my favorite part of the book. And then you have that separate part in the Grey Knights piece. And I think, you know, one of those things where, you know, guys that love the Grey Knights, love the models, love the fluff, they'll run a whole Grey Knight army. And then you're basically running a flawed army. I mean, they didn't write in anti-tank when Grey Knights can only take strength 5 and 6 weapons.
Right.
You know, and the only way you can get stronger than that is either to
orbital
take a dreadnought. Yeah.
You get that one shot. You hope to God he deploys his shit there, orbital strike.
Yeah, either that or you take a heavy support land raider that has 2 las cannons, or you take a heavy support dreadnought. And that's it.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, it was always a flawed army because everybody knew that if you had tanks, the first thing you had to do was drop, like, the 2 Dreadnoughts and the Land Raider in one turn, which, let's be honest, wasn't that hard.
Right.
And then you could just walk all over them. Like,
yeah,
They couldn't get you out.
Right. Well, I mean, with the changes to vehicles in this edition, them just being that much stronger and harder to kill, you know, throwing the Grey Knights Land Raider in there is, like you say, it's really the only option. I love Orbital Strike. I think that that's one of the things in that book that really stood out to me is just being like, you know what? That's a cool little addition. You know, like it adds an aspect of just kind of fun to the game, and it does give them a little bit of a competitive edge in that idea that you're going to get some ordnance that is guaranteed compared to other armies where, you know, like if you're playing Tau and you're playing an Imperial Guard army, you know, you hope for that first turn. You hope to God you get first turn because you know his broadsides are just going to pop your Lehman Russ tanks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think
unless you're Terry.
in which case you're going to roll a whole bucket load of ones and twos.
That is the truth.
No, but I mean, I think what I loved most about the Demon Hunters book, and I love it to this day, and even in a fifth edition world, I've always been tempted to go and do it. Is this was a book that is true to the fluff, you
oh,
know,
God,
and
yes.
And. And we talked about how the atrocity that was the Chaos Space Marine Codex because they took those steps back from the fluff because the Demon Hunters book even says, hey, look, you know, we have Grey Knights. Hey, you know, Chamber Militant. Yay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then you have Inquisitors and Inquisitors. You have Puritans and you have Radicals. And if you take Demon Hosts, you cannot have Grey Knights because they simply would not fight with this. So, I mean, you had
and it's
all
not like
these...
that was a strategic thing. They weren't just like, oh, Demon Hosts and Grey Knights are unbalanced. It was purely a fluff based decision.
Well, exactly, because the Grey Knights would murder the Demon Hosts. Like they
and the
they
Inquisitor
don't work
who
with,
summoned
and
them.
And the Inquisitor that summoned them. Exactly. You know, it's just one of those things where it's just like the Grey Knights don't put up with that bullshit.
That's
and
the
so,
truth, yeah.
You know, and so you had those fluff decisions. So when you sat down with that book and you said, I want to do an Inquisition army, you then had to sit down and say, is it going to be a Puritan or is it going to be a Radical or am I going to try to mix it with some of the War Gear options and some of the unit options?
Well, some of the Radical lists were really fun. You know, where you saw guys going around using the Demon Hosts as like tactical nukes where they'd have 3 of them on the table just running around causing havoc like mad. And then they would have the Inquisitor with, you know, power armor and a demon hammer and all these awesome pieces of war gear that you just don't really see anymore in other codex. That's what drew me in. Like, that's what really kind of grabbed my attention was, like you say, how embedded it is in the fluff and the allied rules where, you know, you could take them in a guard army. You could take them in a Space Marines army or a Sisters of Battle army. You know, like the allied rules I thought were just a totally fun addition to the game because the list that I had originally built for my Imperial Guard had an Inquisitor in it as an ally.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And I love that that ally thing was a two-way street. So,
yeah.
I mean, the Inquisitor was able to induct Marines or Guardsmen mm-hmm. to help plug the holes that were intentionally built into the book. Because basically,
yes.
this was the 40K equivalent of the old Beastmen book, where it's just like, no, this fully integrates with the other Chaos book that's out there. You're able
right.
to pick and choose and mix and match. And we built it with that in mind, and that's why this book has holes in it, you know, because you can induct these guardsmen and you can do all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I've always loved the idea to this day of running that radical Inquisitor with
yep.
demon hosts and stormtroopers and inducted guardsmen as PDF.
Yep.
You know,
and I felt like they, you know, like they had really awesome psychic powers. They had very cool war gear that was very specific and fun, and you know, like the demon hammer is, you know, a thunder hammer that strikes first against, you know,
well,
demons.
It strikes at
initiative, which is
phenomenal.
Yeah, it was fun. It was that whole idea of just like, but here's where this army excels and here's where it stands out. It doesn't mean that it's useless against other armies. It just means that, you know, when you're playing this game now, of course, after that, they did, you know, split up the Chaos Marine books so that, you know, demons were something completely different. And then they had the Demons of Chaos book for Warhammer 40,000. And, you know, it was just, you know, after that, it was weird. Like, you would almost expect, like, oh, there's a pure demon army out there now. Hey, all of a sudden, I've got two demon armies that I can fight. But it didn't seem like that helped them. You know what I mean? Like, when the Demons of Chaos came out, it was just like, well, if you're playing Demon Hunters, you'll fuck them.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's no two ways about it. You will lose because the demons have so much more that it almost feels like, even with all of those cool little trinkets and all those cool little abilities, that they're just so outmatched.
Yeah, you know, and I do think that, yeah, with some of the really sort of weird demons that were available in the books, like, you know,
yeah.
Plague Bearers are hard for anyone to deal with, and
yes.
Demon Hunters, you know, unless you're running pure Grey Knights, didn't really get, you know, great ways to solve that problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, I don't know. I love the Demon Hunters book. I think it's great. To this day, I still always get those draws to do that radical Inquisitor army. But like I said, right now they're kind of that Dark Eldar unicorn bait where it's just like, no, they're coming out soon.
Yes.
I swear, no, Games Workshop is working on them.
No, we promise.
No, look, yeah, I swear.
Chaos Wars right around the corner.
Yeah,
they're coming.
Yeah, we're not going to, you know, they're not going to be squatted, okay? They're
yeah.
not going to turn into squats. I swear to God they're coming. Because, I mean, even then, like, I remember over the summer, they were just like, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, Grey Knights could be, you know, in November. And then
mm-hmm.
it turned out, no, Dark Eldar were. So they're like, oh,
right.
yeah, Grey Knights for sure, January, February.
Right.
And now we you know, we basically have, if you go on a Warseer and look at those rumors, we basically have confirmation of, you know, January through April and what's coming out there. And Grey Knights are nowhere to be found.
Nope.
And now it's just like, you know, who knows? Grey Knights might come out this year. They should. And you're just like, I've heard this song and dance before.
Yes.
I'm a Dark Eldar player. I've
all
heard
this song
this
and
before.
Dance before. No, but, you know, I mean, the interesting thing about the whole Demon Hunters, Witch Hunters, Alien Hunters idea was, you know, they had this great idea. They went full out when they did the Demon Hunters book, and then they came out with the Sisters of Battle and the Witch Hunters, and they did it in such a way where it was like, it was clear in that book that the focus was all about the Sisters of Battle, not
yep.
necessarily the Witch Hunter side of things, because the Witch Hunter side of things was kind of fucking retarded for the Witch Hunters. Like,
well,
I love
know,
the models, but like, they were terrible, terrible rules.
Well, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you compare the Inquisitors,
but here,
let me
finish what I was saying
like
though. By the time they finished the Witch Hunters book, they had blown their load on Demon Hunters. The second spurt was the Witch Hunters, and they were dry for Alien Hunters. That was it. So, I mean, like, that's why, as far as I knew, like, that's why we never saw Alien Hunters, you know, which was a real shot for me because I thought, boy, like, I can't wait for this. This is really going to be the one that sells it because I always loved Death Watch from the fluff and, like, the whole idea of, like, every Marine chapter sends somebody off to Death Watch. Like, I loved that shit. I felt like that was just one of the – because that was vanilla Marines with a little bit more fun to them, with a little bit more depth, and they were, like, the best of the best. And they had all this cool extra, like, awesome gear. And it was just like, to this day, you're still using that chapter approved from White Dwarf.
Yeah, like
it's
Rhinox
sad.
Riders.
But like you were saying?
No, that
before
is
I
what
interrupted
I was
you with the metaphor about semen?
Look, I don't even mind, because when is that not appropriate? Or rather,
whoa.
When is it not funny?
Dude, gay. It's your fault.
No,
go ahead.
It's totally my fault. No, but I mean, you even see the, as I was saying, you see the difference between the Inquisitors, because with the Demon Hunters Inquisitors, you know, there was very black and white differences between a Puritan and a Radical.
Yes.
And then, you know, when I went into the Witch Hunters book, because, you know, I love the fluff. I love the idea of, like, you know, these are the people that police the police, you know.
Right.
And I loved it, and I looked in and I was like, I want to do a Radical Witch Hunter. And then I went through the book and I'm just like, how is it even possible to do a Radical Witch Hunter? I'm like,
right.
What makes them radical?
Well, that's the whole thing, is witch hunters are never radical, right? Like, that was where it kind of, like, they had this idea of, we're going to perpetuate this to the next book. But when the first book was so heavily entrenched in fluff, and you got to the second book and you tried to keep that going, it was like, well, the fluff doesn't support it, because witch hunters were the guys who went and hunted down other inquisitors from the other ordos. You know, like, if you read Inquisitor Eisenhorn, you know, there was the witch hunter hunting him down because he was a radical alien hunter, right? Like, that was what made the witch hunters interesting.
And if
in
you
the terms of
read
fluff.
Eisenhorn, pause, go read the trilogy, you can come back.
No spoilers. I
yeah,
promise.
Oh my
no
god,
spoilers.
It is fantastic.
It's a great, great series. Dag Nabbit is the best.
Indeed. You know, but yeah, I absolutely agree. And so, I mean, I don't want to labor the point anymore, but it's just, I am excited. If Grey Knights ever come out again and I still have the ability to run a Radical Inquisitor, I'm all over it. Honestly,
well, I mean,
because
you know,
I love it from a fluff perspective. I
yeah.
just think it's so cool, especially if you've read Eisenhorn. That's
oh,
when
God,
you're just
yes.
like, oh
well,
my
he was
God,
an alien hunter. He was an alien hunter. That's why I was so stoked for, like, you know, like, oh my God. Ravener, Eisenhorn, they were both alien hunters. Like, motherfucker, give me a fucking Ordo Xenos Inquisitor. I will love it. And Death Watch? And Death Watch? Oh, like, I would... come on, do I have to make another semen metaphor? Jesus Christ. Like, that was the glory book. I was waiting for it. You know, I've got all my shoulder pads and, like, specialized bolters ordered in bits, sitting there waiting, ready to, like, make my fucking Death Watch on a moment's
ready to
notice.
Blow his load all
oh,
over that army.
You have no idea. I've got Death Watch blue balls. Let's move on to the topic that doesn't involve me making semen metaphors.
Well,
and,
we promise nothing on Jaded Gamercast. I want to say this right
now.
There
are no guarantees. I'm sorry. Jason, if at this point it's bothering you that much, just turn off, okay? Just turn it off. But no, you know, I did, before we actually get into the topic that we had here for today, we did receive a bit of mail from Brett, who works for a company that shall not be named. There's probably a joke in there somewhere, but it would give it away. So I'm just going to say whatever, Brett. He posted on the site. If you guys are on the jadedgamercast.com site, you'll see that he posted. He was enraged. He was boiling blood and naked after the comments from Terry regarding the Dark Elves, which was more funny than anything else. But he actually did have a comment with regards to kill points, which I wanted to get your opinion on very quickly, Nathan. He had asked how we felt about a flat kill point system. Now, what I mean by that is that when you go into a game, now this is something that the Australians were very heavily in approval of, which was basically for 40K, you
Ooh, I
add,
already don't like it.
Well, you know, oi, fucker, mate. How you going, Nathan? Anyways, but no, it was basically this idea that, like, okay, kill points are unbalanced, and I don't want to get into an argument about your point, because, again, your point is going to remain the same for this, which is that kill points and terrain objectives are what balance, they balance each other out, as opposed to one being unbalanced or the other being unbalanced. But this
I
is
mean,
my thing.
Three episodes worth, I won't belabor the point, but go on.
Exactly. But basically, he had asked, you know, like, how do you feel about a 10 kill point system where basically you go into a game, you've got 10 kill points per army, and you assign it to various units, or you assign according to unit point costs, or like, okay, you go down the line, you say one kill point for every HQ unit, one kill point for every heavy support, one kill point for every core, and then you basically use up your 10 kill points, and there will be certain units on the table which are considered inconsequential in some way, shape, or form that are not worth any sort of kill points. To me, before you get into this, to me, this system only works if you have like 20 or more kill points to assign. It starts becoming a bit labored at that point, but it does return to that kind of feeling of balance, where basically if you only have 17 units in your army and you've got 20 kill points to assign, that means three units in your army are going to be worth two kill points apiece, which is like HQ units or elite units or like really high point cost units. To me, this is good, but the biggest problem with this is that it does add an extra layer to the game when it comes to deployment and list building and all these different types of things. I think that a tournament organizer doing their due diligence can make this work. But I feel that, you know, your argument is very valid, which is basically that, you know, well, kill points are balanced out by the imbalances in terrain. So I would say sure. If you were playing specialized scenarios that were all based on kill points, I think that that would be exceptionally fair. But I think in a tournament setting, I do have to go back to agree with Nathan and Terry after our last episode, where, you know, they made a very good argument with regards to the fact that, like, well, you know, you can't get one without the other. And they're both in balance, but together they're in balance, right? You know, it's the yin and the yang, the dark side and the light side, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a nerd.
Look, dude, I have a Star Wars tattoo and I'm getting another one.
I know. I have to figure out what my Star Wars, because I have the one on the one arm and I'm going to get the tattoo on the other arm. I have to figure out what I want. It's going to be Star Wars. I'm thinking a Carillion Corvette down my bicep.
Yeah.
That might be all right.
Nice. Yeah.
Welcome to Jaded Nerdcast. My slang with me is always his name.
Dude, we just lost all right. I don't know whether we lost half our listeners or doubled it with that one. I just
we
don't
didn't
know.
We're talking about the prequels, so I don't think we lost anyone.
It is true. No, I kind of want to address that because you know, basically what it comes down to me is right off the bat, I don't like it. Okay. And this is why. Now, your typical balanced 40K army at tournament sizes in that 1500 to 2000 point sweet spot.
I'll cut you off real quick here. I'm not going to read his entire email because he wrote us a novel. I'm not looking for another John Wong email. Basically, that is the boiled down version of, like, that is the cliff notes of his email. But anyways,
yeah.
Go on. I'm sure he'll have something like, well, no, this is what I meant. But
yeah,
that's the cliff notes. So, yeah.
Fair enough. No, but the point I want to make is if you are building a balanced list out of most codexes, okay, I mean, there are going to be some exceptions, and I'll talk about them in a sec. In the 1500 to 2000 point range, your army can expect to have anywhere from 8 to about 12 or 13, 14 kill points top. So, I mean,
right,
you're already hovering around that 10 kill point marker. So for most armies, it's not going to affect you at all. Okay. What I want to talk about, and this is why I don't like it, are the extremes. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about mech vet spam. Now, your typical 2000 point mech vet guard list of douchiness. So if you play one, you heard it here first. You're a douche.
Nathan, don't offend people. We would never want to do that on this show.
Or blow our loads.
Well, okay, listen, if you can make a semen metaphor in the next 2 minutes, you get a gold star, my friend.
Okay, I will try, but I promise nothing.
Okay.
But no, I mean, if you look at your typical mech vet spam, basically what you're looking at is 4 to 6 units of veterans, 1 or 2 company command squads, psyker battle squad, All loaded up in tanks. So if I play this list, because I'm a dick, when I look at this scenario, I know I've won. Why? Because my 10 kill points are going to be the 10 units inside the tanks. I will never get out of my tanks. And now you have to basically obliterate all 10 of my tanks, or more, 10 or more, just to get at my kill points. Okay?
Right.
So basically, I as the opponent, will spend the entire game, and I will blast apart tank after tank after tank. I might get one or two veteran units, and at the end of the day, I'm going to lose, because here I am with my very typical list with my, you know, with my 10 kill points. He's killed 5 or 6 units. I've blown up, you know, 9 tanks and killed 1 unit of vets, and I lose by 8 kill points, you know. And I think that's what I don't like about it, is mech'd up armies abuse it the same way that knob squads right. abuse wound allocation.
Well, you're not talking about extremes. You're talking about loopholes, right? And I mean, like, there's a lot of loopholes. Like I said, a tournament organizer could mitigate this to an extent with certain types of scenarios, but I think that you are absolutely right. I think, you know, when I first heard this idea, you know, it seemed like it was just like, hey, that fixes the problem. But the more you look at it, the more you realize that, you know, considering this shared intellect of internet lists and, you know, crap like that, it would just be like, ah, here's how you win that tournament. You know, you and I had a good conversation earlier in the week over chat, basically talking about somebody who had posted on Warseer about their unbeatable elf high elf list, where it was just like 120 archers in the folding fortress. You can't beat it, but it's always a draw. And it was just a ridiculous post where, you know, it's just like, this is a fucking stupid, ridiculous, like, retarded loophole type army. It's not invincible. It's not unbeatable. But is it hard? Yes. I mean, all you're doing is trying to play for not a draw, which is fucking stupid.
Yeah. No, and the other thing is like I said, a set kill point mission is going to heavily favor mechanized armies.
Yes.
And when you look at the current tournament metagame, mechanized armies, you know, is the new black. You know, you're going to go, you're going to see at least 50% of all armies that are going to be all mech, whether they're Marines, Chaos Marines, or Guardsmen. It just doesn't matter.
Orcs, Eldar, Tau, they all do it.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, you know, basically what you're saying is we want Tyranids to lose every game because they can't get tanks. And then we're going to create a system where if two mech armies run up against each other, it's a draw every game.
Right.
Because if all I'm doing is blowing up worthless tanks.
That is a good point. I think that that's a very intelligent answer, which is uncharacteristic for you. But moving on to our main topic. I'm drinking a lot of scotch. But okay, let's talk about our topic. You are going to be in Vegas for a tournament next week.
Yes, January the 15th. So awesome. Saturday.
That's fantastic. It further reinforces what you said in the first episode, which is you travel a lot for tournaments. But going into that, we felt like...
Yeah, I think, okay, no, I mean, this is the start of 2011, but yeah, last year I think I drove for tournaments over 3,000 kilometers.
Well, and you and I and Nick have a five to six hour drive coming up in February for a tournament.
You have a 5 to 6 hour drive. Nick and I have like a 7 to 8 hour drive.
Yeah, that's true as well. But, you know,
worth it.
It's worth it. It'll be a fun tournament in GP Town.
Yeah.
You can't crack the code. but okay, so one of the things we kind of wanted to talk about was tournament prep. So I felt like a way to kind of get into this is, Nathan, what are you doing to prepare for this tournament? In terms of your army list, in terms of painting, in terms of practice games or research, because I mean, anyone who's really serious about tournaments, they'll go online and they'll research lists. You know, they'll go into that list building section on Warseer and try to figure out what's the metagame, what's going to be prominent in the tournament. Like, how do I want to build my list to come out on top?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, basically how I've been preparing for this tournament, it started almost 2 months ago. So basically the moment I committed to going and I bought my plane ticket,
right.
That was when, you know, it was sort of on for me. And so it started with a very sort of organic way to build lists. Now I personally, you know, I play Tyranids. They're my main tournament army. And I always try to run against the metagrain. You know, I always try to rub against the grain. Because I know that if I build a
There's
list.
a semen metaphor in there somewhere.
I just try to rub it out. You know, I just rub and I rub and I rub and I just try to come up against it. You know, just the tip, just the tip.
This is shameless. Absolutely. There is no dignity in this podcast. I think that one is clear at this point.
God, you know, I blame Matt for lowering the standards. Yeah.
Matt is the bar.
It is. Or does he drink as much as the bar? I don't know.
Well, when he's not blown an Irishman, but moving on.
We have video proof.
It's true.
No, but like I said, the way I build lists is I like to build a list that can handle the metagame.
Right.
You know, so I build a list that can blow up tanks, that can take out Thunderwolf Cav, that can do all of the stuff that, you know, Bell of Lost Soul and Warseer says is how you win games. So I always make sure that my lists can counter that. But at the same time, I try to approach it and build from a direction that nobody expects, nobody sees coming. Because when I run units that nobody has ever seen before, they don't know how to deal with it.
Right.
You know, back in October when I started this process, I started sort of coming up with lists and different ideas and, you know, talking it through with people here and going online and reading and doing this and doing that. And eventually, like I said, my list grew and evolved and it's finally at something that I'm quite happy about. And I'm totally willing to post my list if anyone asks for it.
You're playing 40K, right? You're playing your Tyranids.
Yes, playing gotcha. 40K. It is a 40K only tournament.
Mm-hmm.
The gaming club that is putting it on runs a fantasy only tournament in March, but I don't think I'm going to have the funds or time to do
We got a fantasy tournament in February, so.
Exactly. So it's a 40K only tournament. I'm more than happy to post my list if people are interested in it. But like I said, it grows and it evolves. And once I've kind of come up with the list that I'm 90 to 95% sure I'm going to take, that's when I figure out what do I need to paint? What do I need to acquire and work on and paint to make the list work? Now, luckily for this particular list, I needed to paint one model brand new as well as go through, and I think I have to fix the chips on my unit of Zoanthropes because I've been running that unit since like 2007 and I have never once fixed the chips.
Well, and usually I don't feel like never fall over.
Oh, yeah, exactly. God, they're like one of the sturdiest models. Right now, it looks like I tried to put my Zoanthropes in the blender for Will It Blend, and turns out they won't.
Fancy. I think you've got a really good point there, which is that you build lists to take people out of their comfort zone. For me, you know, and to kind of begin the foundations of what I want to talk about here, you know, there are two different kinds of people when it comes to tournament prep, right? There are the types of people that play the same list over and over again, and their tournament prep is experience and, you know, feeling as comfortable as possible, knowing their list, you know, being dedicated to what they have, and hoping that that knowledge and dedication will allow them to push through and win games. And then there are people who the majority of the games that they play outside of a tournament are essentially their tournament prep. I mean, you and I, when you and I have games of Warhammer Fantasy, you know, we always talk about like, well, how would I take this to a tournament? Like, what would I want to change? I mean, we have 3-hour conversations after the game just talking about like how we're going to change our list for next time, which is very odd because, you know, a lot of people who do the same thing, they tend to overreact to losses.
Mm-hmm.
They will have a loss and they will say to themselves, you know, like, ah, oh, that unit was garbage. I'm going to throw it out and build something new. Or this unit works, so I'm going to double the number of units like that I have in my list. You know,
a little bit of salt makes my food taste good. A lot of salt.
Well, it's just that overreaction where it's just like, oh my God, the Terminators did awesome this game. I should take 2 units of Terminators. Or it's just like, well, you don't need 2 units of Terminators. You know, like you can't just forego things because you look at this one unit of you know, Chaos Knights and they didn't perform that game. They're still a vital part of your army. And what I always like to try to tell people is, you know, when you built the list the first time, if you took the time to really put the effort into building a balanced list, you were probably right the first time. You know, like there's always going to be a couple things that you're going to tweak, but for the most part, your list will generally remain the same. So I tend to try to not over, like, what was it you said to me earlier this week when we were talking about my lizard men?
I was saying,
like, what were you saying? Like, were you going to get rid of like Temple Guard or something like that because they didn't do this or this, that game? And I was just like, no, not changing a thing. Part of that is because
I wasn't telling you to change. I was just suggesting that you run one of your other armies for the tournament. Cause I was your lizardmen are okay. Your lizardmen do okay in these situations, but there are lots of other situations where I felt some of your other armies were stronger. And that was my point.
My ogres.
Yes. Your ogres specifically. I think your ogres would wreck shit.
I've had very good games with my ogres so far. So, I mean, I definitely see that. However, for me, you know, like I want to get my lizardmen painted, and an upcoming tournament is the best way to be motivated to paint an army. So I want to get my lizardmen painted. That's part of the tournament prep for me. But even in the games that I lost, I was comfortable with my army. And I think that to me, that's the most important thing to tournament prep is, are you comfortable with your army? Are you comfortable with facing anything that comes your way? Okay, well, then you will do well. I'm not saying you're going to win the tournament. I'm saying you'll probably do well if you are comfortable with your army. Because, you know, like Mike Frang, you know, him and I had our game where he played his Empire and I played my Orcs. Dude always plays Empire. You know, he's always comfortable. He comes into tournaments with that comfort level and dedication to his army, and that does do him fairly well. Unless he plays a really good player, and then, you know, they just maul him, and it's hilarious. But
yeah, like that last game he played, right?
Oh, fuck you. That was not my, you know, my dice have changed. I swear, you better get ready to come in.
Hey, listen,
for that tournament in GP Town, because I swear, my dice have changed. Okay.
Look, we've already set the challenge that if me and Lang do not play at the tournament in GP Town, we are going to play in the hotel if necessary. If the venue kicks us out, we are going to play in the hotel just so I can thoroughly trounce him a third time and prove that his lizard men are shit.
Vengeance.
And that's what it comes down to.
It will be vengeance, my friend. In both games that we played, I was relatively confident. I mean, the first game, I did trim some stuff off after the first game because I had some dead weight in my list. Second game, I'm sorry. Even you after the second game was like, yeah, I should have lost. I should have lost. You outplayed me. I am confident and I am comfortable with my list. And that's my whole point for tournament prep is that I'm comfortable with my Lizardman list. I'm not going to change it. That's not going to change for the tournament because, you know, like I might change like a little magic item here or there just to kind of try things out and see what is more effective or not. But my big thing is for tournament prep, be comfortable. Don't overreact and just get your stuff painted, you know? But I think that that's the biggest part of tournament prep for me is, am I comfortable with the list that I'm playing going into the tournament? Because I've gone into tournaments with lists where I felt like I'm trying something new or, you know, it's a list that I haven't really play tested enough to be very confident with. And that tournament, I just got crushed. I mean, my vampire counts have an awesome record. I think I've only lost 4 games with my vampire counts out of like 25. But literally those like 3 of those 4 games were in a tournament, like a 4-game tournament where I got massacred 3 times in a row because I kept trying to do something different or I felt like I was overreacting or it was just like, I'm just going to take this unit out. I don't want him. I don't want to do that because it's a bad idea. You know,
that's actually a very good point because I remember when I went to Ardboy's semifinals, you know, in my game too, that was exactly the thing where it's just like, you know, I had a list that I was comfortable with. It had absolutely wrecked shit against a Leafblower guard army list.
Yep.
And then I ran up into this very atypical, you know, Marine list. And so I was just like, you know, look at this list. It's weak. It's soft. I'm going to do these random silly things and try them out. And I wasn't comfortable. And that was the game where you know, I was able to win it on objectives. But, like, I think my last 2 turns were just all of my scoring units going to ground.
Just scrambling. Just like,
yeah, exactly. It was scrambling. And all I was trying to do was hold on to my objectives and hopefully disrupt one of his to force the win, which I did. You know, success there. But it was one of those things where you're absolutely right. You need to be familiar. You need to be comfortable, because the moment you step out of that comfort zone, the moment you start taking things for granted, or you start thinking, you know, about breaking the mold, because I mean, hell, you might be bored, but you know, if you stick to this and it, you know, it's proved that it works in the past, it's going to continue to give you results. Right. And tournaments are the places where you need to just sort of stick to your guns. You need to do what you need to do. Because if you want to fuck around, if you want to play with shit, that's part of your tournament prep. You know, whether, you know, if you're going to change your tactics or you're going to swap this unit for that unit, you don't want to do dumb shit like that in a tournament. So, I mean, that almost cost me the game, which would have cost me any chance of, you know, breaking and going to the finals, basically. Yeah. You know, I got lucky that game.
No,
it
for sure.
It seems to be a recurring theme.
Ugh, fuck you.
Anytime I start losing games, my luck just goes through the roof, and I'm just like, hey.
Well, you know, like, it's a dice game, and that's part of the game is luck, you know? Like, that's kind of what the game is all about, is there's a certain amount of random chance to it, and even the best laid plans always do fail. So, you know, like, that's what makes it fun. That's why we enjoy the game. But, you know, when it comes to tournament prep, I feel like there is a certain amount of research that needs to be involved, whether your research is, you know, going out to gaming nights and playing other armies, trying different types of things, you know, building proxy lists and putting them out on the internet and trying to get feedback on them. You know, like, I think there's this.
Oh, God, I never do that.
Well, I'm not saying I do it. I'm just saying some people do it.
No, it's true. You know,
but you're never going to see two people who will advocate heavier than myself and Nathan for building a balanced take all comers list.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. Because I mean, I actually had this this debate on one of our listeners you know, Facebook pages. Mike, this one's for you. you know, where they just posted all of the lists for both Fantasy and 40K for the UK GT Masters, I think, whatever. The top players in the UK. And they posted all their lists, and you know, Fantasy's not my super strong tournament strong point. I mean, I love the game, but I don't feel like I've played enough 8th edition to really comment on it. Plus, the only army that I know inside and out is Wood Elves, and you know, again, you listen to the internet, Wood Elves are auto lose. So
unless you're playing Lizard, I'm gonna beat you to the joke. Unless you're playing Lizardmen.
You did beat me to the joke.
Fuck you. I'm gonna
You know, but I mean, so it's just like I looked at the list and you know, I kind of raised an eyebrow, but I didn't think that I was really qualified to comment on them.
Sure.
When I looked at the 40K Tyranid lists, I looked at lists that basically have auto lose buttons built into them. So so basically these two Tyranid players both put all of their eggs in one basket, and that basket was, please, oh, please, let me run into a mech'd up army. Right. You know, if they do, their lists are phenomenal.
They're banking on the metagame.
Exactly. Yeah. They're going to win every game.
Right.
If they ever...
And again, to reiterate for anyone who doesn't understand what we mean when we say metagame, the metagame is essentially everything outside of actually what is happening on the tabletop and the general ship. This is taking into account the community, the rules, the tournament organizers, I mean, all these different types of things. We had talked about a little bit in episode 2 with Kyle, when we basically said that, like, a big part of tournaments is you go online and you look at all these lists and you do the research and you realize that the majority of people who are gearing up to play top tier lists and leaf blowers and this whole shared intellect online, are they're all going to take this. You decide to take the opposite of that to capitalize on it. That's what we mean when we say metagame. It's not the game. It's everything surrounding the game that can still give you a competitive edge.
Yeah, basically, the way I always describe metagame is the metagame is what you think everyone's going to do.
Right.
And that's what it comes down to. But, I mean, when I looked at both Tyranid lists, they were very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them spent one third of their total army points on a single unit. They just spammed the shit out of it. And that unit is only good at blowing up light transports.
Yeah.
You know, anything that is armor 10 and 11, you can guarantee they're going to blow it up in a single round of shooting. Mm-hmm. Armor 12, if they don't blow it up, they're going to fuck it up to the point where it's useless. Armor 14, they can only glance. Armor 13, they're really going to struggle against. So, but I mean, if you spam enough of them, they're going to be able to get the job done.
They're expecting mechanized.
And that was exactly my point. And I looked at those lists and I laughed because basically they said, if I don't run into a mech army, I'm going to concede the loss because that unit in particular is crap. Mm-hmm. You know, in almost every other situation when it's not shooting at a light vehicle. I mean, on the Facebook page, there were, you know, they listed the two examples mm-hmm. where the unit still does shine versus infantry, and that is versus Orc Knobs and Tyranid Warriors.
Right.
In
the
every
wound allocation bullshit.
Well, yeah, because they were strength 8 AP4 guns that denied cover, so, you know, they ignore intervening cover, so the unit has to be inside the cover to pull a cover save. So, I mean,
yes,
they're a phenomenal unit, one of the best in the Tyranid Codex. But if they're not shooting at vehicles, they need to be shooting at Tyranid Warriors or Knobs, period. Otherwise, you're wasting your points. And they spent one third of their army on that unit. And I'm just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, all of your lists would be better if you said, I'm going to take one unit of this. I'm going to take, you know, some of this, like spread the love around, because if either of those lists hit a land raider, they can't kill it.
Right.
There's nothing in either list that can handle an armor 14 all around vehicle.
And that's when you hope for like an objective type mission or a kill point mission where you don't really have, you can almost ignore the land raider the entire mm-hmm. fight and still try to pull out a win. I think the big thing that we really want to impress on people with regards to tournament prep is, I mean, and again, I think Nathan will agree with me on this, you know, because this is our podcast. We just like virtually jerk each other off about how awesome we are. But wow, that's another one. I think I know the title for this episode. What it really comes down to is that you will never find two bigger advocates for build a balance list, because you would mm-hmm. be surprised how effective a balance list is against these super specialized metagame whoring lists that are expecting to hit the top tier, blah, blah, blah. And they do exceptionally well because of the fact that they can take all comers and they throw a wrench into the gears, into the plans of these people who are building for the metagame or against the metagame. So, I mean, like you've said many times, like you've never lost to a leaf blower list, but apparently it's the greatest list on the internet. It's not because you're building to beat the leaf blower list. You're building a balanced list, and a balanced list will beat that every time.
Well, yeah, you know, I build balanced lists, and I also, you know, maybe we'll talk about different play styles in a different cast. But
topic.
I like to play versus my opponent. You know, for me,
yes,
I and Lang will attest to this. I have no plan. I have absolutely no plan. I move shit randomly. I do the things that look like they're good. And the moment my opponent makes one wrong move, he moves the unit out of position, I fucking pounce and I punish him for it.
Right.
And I play against my, you know, my opponent, which is why, as you said earlier, I build lists that put people out of their comfort zone. Because if they're already wondering what the fuck I'm up to, I'm halfway there to playing my type of game.
Yeah.
And so that is why I beat leaf blower armies, because leaf blower armies are expecting me to deploy and just walk into their guns, because everybody else that plays them does it. And I refuse to play their game. And as a result, I force my game onto them and they don't know how to deal with it.
No, true. It wasn't their list to begin with. They don't even know how to play it from the start. But I agree with you. I agree with you, because I think that comfort level is a huge, huge factor in the game. You know, I mean, it really does make the difference. I mean, people who are coming in with lists that they're comfortable with. I mean, I make fun of Kyle for playing the same list for the past 6 years or 10 years or however long he's had that fucking Empire army. But the dude plays it well. He knows his army, right? Like, he's comfortable with what he has on the table. And so he plays it well. He does well with it. Same thing with Mike. Same thing with you and the Wood Elves, because you play the Wood Elves well, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've been playing that. They are my only fantasy army, and I've been playing them in tournaments since 2006.
Yeah, and, you know, like you said before, I mean, I'm probably better off playing my Vampire Counts because I have more experience with them, but I want to finish my Lizard Men. I feel like they're going to be a really good addition to, you know, the armies that I have. And after that, like I said before in the last podcast, I'm excited to get to work on my Space Marines, which is probably going to be my next project after I finish my Lizard Man.
No, that's nice, because see, I just realized that my next three projects are all repainting the only three armies that I have.
You're such a fucking ass.
Aren't I?
Yeah,
no,
true.
No, you know, it's just, you know, I look, like, I love all of the armies that I play, I love for a certain reason, and it's gotten to the point where I myself am a better painter, and I take pride in my painting,
yes.
And so I can look at the shit that I did for my Wood Elves, and, you know, when I did them in 2006, I was just like, man, this shit is awesome, this is like the gold standard, and now I look at them, and all I have to do is, like, sigh and shake my head, because I'm capable of so much better now.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the truth.
And so whereas you just sort of move on
yeah.
and take your increased painting skills to newer armies, and, you know, you'll throw back your old orcs, who, to be honest, compared to your lizardmen, are painted like shit.
Yeah, they're fucking terrible.
You know, but I mean, like, for me, I look at that and I'm just like, but I still love this army and I want to be proud in it and I want to show it off and I want it to be beautiful. And that's why, like I said, I was just looking at my projects and I'm just like, you know, repaint my Wood Elves, repaint my Dark Eldar, and now I'm working with a friend of mine who wins Best Painted all the time, and he's going to help me jazz up my Tyranids to up my painting scores, because really that is what has been keeping me from winning tournaments. I mean, I think I've finished top five in every tournament I've gone to with my Nids.
I can say I would agree with that. I would say that if you bring your painting up to that next level and you really add a little bit of flash to it, I think that you would place a lot better, because I go into tournaments and I've won Best Painted twice, and you know, my painting scores are always very high, which oddly enough is offset by my sportsmanship scores, which I never quite understand.
It's because you're an asshole.
It's true.
It's that simple.
Well, you know, it's all those racist jokes I tell during the game, but no, I mean, you know, like,
and the semen jokes.
Well, those are like a staple of my gameplay. It's part of my competitive shit talk. But, you know, like, it really does, you know, I feel like that would bring your game up, because you and I are about the same. We go into tournaments, we typically place anywhere within the top five or the top 10. I've won, I think, two tournaments. How many have you won? I think you've won three.
Yep.
Right. And so it's just like, you know, like, we do relatively well, but we all have our deficits, right? But I think when it comes to tournament prep, again, kind of getting back to the topic at hand, you know, my big thing is be comfortable. What's your number one point for tournament prep, Nathan?
You know, other than the comfort, I think my number one point is go there with no expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was younger and,
right.
You know, I won't say less arrogant, because I think I'm way more arrogant now.
But when I was a podcast now, of course you're more arrogant.
Fuck yeah. Look, people are actually listening to me. Suckers.
Oh my God, I have an audience.
When I
Let
was
me get
younger,
my podium out.
That's right. Whose cock is bigger now? Whose cock?
Do not bring that into the podcast.
But I mean, when I was younger, I would go to tournaments and I would just be like, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and be like, there's no fucking way I can lose. I got this list. I'm comfortable with it. I've play tested it to shit. There's no fucking way I can lose. And I would go in and, you know, one loss would ruin the entire experience. And so I would be absolutely upset by it. I would leave that tournament and I would just be like, what the fuck was that? Why did I waste my time? You know, this and that. But now, you know, I go in and I have no expectations. I know that the difference between me winning and me not winning is a good day versus a bad day. Sometimes the dice fuck you.
Yeah.
Nothing you can do about it. Or sometimes there's someone that is simply better than you there. And that's out of your control. So, I mean, now I approach tournaments, and this is part of the reason I like to travel to them for so much. I approach tournaments because I want to meet new people.
Yeah.
And
it's that social,
you know,
aspect. We kind of talked about that after the mailbag.
You know, absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, again, most of my friends come from this hobby. I have met very few douchebags that play 40K. I mean, they exist. Douchebags are everywhere, unfortunately.
There's a
few. Yeah. But the overwhelming amount of people that I meet are all great people that are fun to hang out with. I mean, that's part of the reason I went to Spokane twice this year.
Yeah.
Down in Country Stand. Or Neighbor Stand. down in Neighbor Stand. You know, because
you know, you and I are the only ones who still think that's funny.
It's like, you know, hi mom jokes.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's basically it. You know, but I mean, I went down the first time specifically because that was the nearest semifinals for Ardboys to where I lived. So I went down there. I met all of these super chill, super awesome people. And after that, you know, when they were like, oh, and there's another tournament, you know, a month and a half later, I was just like, I absolutely want to be there. Like, I want to hang out with you guys again.
Right.
And that is why I go. And those are the funnest tournaments you go to, is when you have no expectations other than to play three or four or five or however many games it is, and hopefully meet more awesome people than you will douchebags.
Yeah. I think that we've kind of gone on as much as we're going to go on with regards to the whole tournament prep side of things, because, I mean, really everybody handles it a little bit differently, and everybody kind of has a different view of what makes proper tournament prep, or, you know, like what makes effective tournament prep in any way, shape, or form, because, I mean, it's different for everybody. So before we get into the stupidity for this week, I did want to touch on an email that we did receive from Adam. Adam Tremblay, who, if I remember correctly, isn't he number one for Canada according to Rankings HQ?
Honestly, I never go on that website, so I have no idea.
There you go. See, we do not recognize your work and effort with regards to rankings. But anyways... he had asked, you know, he says, hey, Lang and Nathan, it's Adam from GP. I have an idea for your some such episode of the podcast, if you haven't done it already. He was asking with regards to the purpose for fear and terror in Warhammer Fantasy. Kind of talking a little bit about, like, how drastic the changes were for 8th edition for fear and terror. I'm going to let you take the reins on this one, Nathan, because I've kind of got a prepared answer for this one already.
Word. First, I want to talk about terror first. Okay. Yeah. Personally, I love the changes to terror, because at the end of the day, the new changes to terror, there isn't that 6-inch, you know, oh, you're
no
close
terror
enough
bombs
to me. Yeah, there's no terror bombs. And I mean, I have played game, you know, this was at a tournament once. My Wood Elves opened up and I wiped out a unit of Savage Orcs. There's 15 of them in one shooting phase, which meant everything within 6 inches had to take panic checks. And this was a game where I shit you not. And this was turn two. Every last unit panicked, which ran through his lines because they had to run away from the panicked unit. So he ran across his lines and he failed every leadership check.
Ugh.
Everyone. I felt like shit, you know, because no one wants to win that way. Nobody when it's just like, oh, so it's the top of turn two and I just won the game because you failed every leadership check and your entire army broke and ran and leapfrogged itself off the board.
Right.
The way terror used to work is you used to be able to terror bomb certain armies. Right. You know, if you played low leadership armies like goblins or unassisted empire or any other one of those things, one terror creature gets into the lines and suddenly it's game over. Okay.
Right.
I love that that's not there anymore. Other than that, you know, like I said, I really have no complaints with it. You know, I do like the mechanic of if a terror causing, you know, creature wants to charge you, you have to take a morale check. And then what I like most about it is, you know, because when you look at the turn sequence, the moment I declare that charge, they have to take that leadership check.
Right.
But once we get into the beginning of the assault phase, they have to take this second leadership check for fear. So that's why I think the terror is really balanced out, where it is a very good thing because you're forcing two leadership checks. And Fantasy, unlike 40K, is a game where leadership matters and you can fail and things like that.
This is very true.
Hey, no, maybe.
I think you make a good point. And the point that you are applying to terror also applies to fear, which is basically the parts of those rules that were unbalanced, loophole mongering bullshit has been removed. It wasn't that they tried to alter them to kind of make them work, or, you know, like if you're, you know, like the whole outnumbered by a fear causing unit, you automatically break, like all that bullshit gone. They just cut off the fat. What we have right now is a very trimmed down, lean, mean version of the fear and terror rules. The proper parts of those rules still apply. The idea of, you know, fear versus fear means you just ignore those rules, or terror versus fear means it's just fear. You know, I think that that's all very well and good. I feel like the armies that are bitching and complaining about the changes to fear, and I can say this from personal experience because I have three armies that are based on like fear and terror or immune to psychology or any number of psychology driven pros for the army, is that it's not a deficit. The people who are bitching complaining that, oh, their vampire count armies can't win because I can't fucking build a 50 man skeleton unit to with a vampire lord in it to always win combat and always auto break every fucking mother piece of shit that I run into, it doesn't wreck it. I mean, I've played enough games that I can tell you for sure that the nice thing about it is this. Before, it was you only roll for it once. Terror and mm-hmm. fear in combat. Now it's you roll for that shit every time it comes up. Every turn, every combat. I've had games where in the third round of combat, all of a sudden he fails his leadership test, and when I'm losing that combat, bam, I'm back on top, and my skeletons are hitting on threes. That's huge. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you start coupling that with magic and buffs and things of that nature, it is a devastating failure on the leadership scale. It's not just a you auto break. It's the, oh my God, I'm all of a sudden my skeletons are these awesome type units. I feel that what they really did is they trimmed off the garbage. They left us with what is a proper version of fear and terror. Is it a detriment to vampire counts or ogres or any other army that is based on fear and terror? No, it's not. I'm sorry. You can argue with me on that, but it's not different. You are still playing the exact same strategy, unless you're the fucking mass fear auto break monkey. It's the same strategy. It's the same plan. And actually, you kind of come out on top if you're playing a balanced army with those new fear and terror rules, because all of a sudden now your black coach or your giant or, you know, your wraiths and banshee, every unit they charge can just literally flee off the table if they fail their check. It's like you don't even have to fight. They just run away. It's awesome. It's not because before with banshees and wraiths, if you had a 5-man unit, you never outnumbered your opponent. So if they failed their fear check on a charge, they were just, what was it? Weapon skill one.
Yeah.
Or no. It wasn't weapon skill one. It was just they always hit on sixes. But same thing. Which was like, but I could still lose that combat. Now, fuck, I charge that unit in. There was a chance that that unit of knights literally just runs away and I run them down. Like, mm-hmm. that is a huge advantage when you've got small units that can charge long distances and have terror. That's huge. And the fact is like, even if they rally and you charge them again, they have to make another terror check. It's not like before where it was the terror bomb, where as long as they passed it once in the game, they never had to pass another terror check for the rest of the game. It's literally like you can sit there and just blow units off the table by just attempting charges. Like, it's huge. So I'm sorry. I do not agree with anybody who's sitting there saying that the changes to fear and terror have kneecapped these armies.
Well, and I also want to talk about it from a non-fear-causing army perspective, because, right. You know, I remember for probably the last year and a half to 2 years of 7th edition, when I played my Wood Elves, I literally bought that stupid fucking 100-point magic banner on my Battle Standard Bear, you know, the Royal Standard of Ariel, not because it was a good banner, but because it caused fear.
Right.
And basically what it came down to was I wasn't trying to be the fear monkey. I didn't want my 600-point unit that's stubborn on a 9 with a reroll because my BSB is there to be outnumbered by fear causers and need to roll double ones.
Yes.
And that's what it was, is I remember there was one tournament I went to and that literally cost me the game, where it's just like, you know what? It was just 24 guys with my Battle Center Bear, and I usually bunker my Highborn in there because I gear him for combat, and Wood Elves have very few combat units. And so it's just like, you know, a 600-point unit gets run down because you have lots of zombies.
Right.
What the fuck is this shit? So, I mean, you know, as a non-fear-causing army, you always had to come up with ways to either cause fear or become immune to fear. Like, I remember I would run into Empire armies that ran Luther Huss. Why? Because Luther Huss caused fear. So even though he is an exceptionally expensive warrior priest whose whose point, like, he's not worth it. Like, basically, when it comes down to it, his special rules do not warrant his points cost over, say, a normal warrior priest. People were running
in
him
in 7th
because,
edition, yes.
In 7th edition, you would see him in units simply because he caused fear, which gave granted immunity to fear to a big unit.
Right.
And so it's just like, you know, I'm very, very happy because now I get to actually take what I want rather than dumping points in the, you know, into this one area to say, you know, gee, I hope I don't run into this gimmicky player, but I know I need to spend 100 points on this banner, which means I don't get to take any magic items. I don't get to do anything to make my guy survivable. You know, actually, it's funny because with that banner, he cost more than my highborn.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, and this is just for fear immunity. And I'm just like, what the fuck is this?
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I do agree with you. I do like that terror is every single time. Yeah. Fear is every single round of combat. And, you know, because in fantasy, a very valid strategy is force as many leadership checks as possible, because even the most steadfast of armies are going to fail.
Well, I think that's
whether you're lizardmen, whether you're dwarves, you will fail if you roll enough dice.
Well, that's true. But no, I mean, I think that that's one of the big proponents to fantasy is that the psychology game, even like you said earlier in the podcast, the psychology game for fantasy is so much more important and so much more in depth than it is in Warhammer 40,000, where 2/3 of the armies on the board are fearless or essentially fearless, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, for me, you know, like, I get it. I understand how people can look at this and say, like, my strategy was to be a douche and now I can't be a douche. Well, you know what? You're a douche and that's not going to change. So there's no love for you there from me or Nathan. But I feel like the rules were streamlined. They're more appropriate to the game and they still have the desired effect that you want for armies that are dependent on psychology. You know, so I think that that's something that that's my response to that whole idea is it's just like, how do you feel about fear and terror? I feel like they improved it. I feel like it's right now. It's where it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, anyone who disagrees, I would say, you know what? Play like you used to play before and make it work. Build a balanced list and you will run into those situations where, wow, all of a sudden, I think the biggest problem with fear and terror in this edition is just remembering to roll for it every combat.
Yeah,
had so many games where it's just like, fuck, I should have made you roll for terror or fear, and it's just like, damn it. I think that's the biggest, you know, I mean, hey, anybody who plays fantasy has skipped their magic phase by accident at one point or another. It happens.
Yeah, so that's right. One. That's the, only one.
That's the biggest problem with the changes to Fear and Terror is just remembering to roll for it every turn going from 7th edition to 8th edition. But we are kind of crawling to the end of our show today, so I'm going to kick us right into the stupidity check for this week, which is, Nathan, it's your turn. Stupidity check.
All right. I'm actually going to kick this one old school because it was a failed stupidity check many years ago, and they've yet to pass it, and that is Games Workshop's whole stance on bits.
Oh, fuck them.
Yeah.
I mean Games Workshop, not bits.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's going to hurt.
No.
You're just going to rub it, and it's going to hurt.
Anybody who has seen my bits box knows that I love bits.
Yeah.
I mean, I convert models like a madman, and I mean, like, I used to order bits like crazy, and...
Yeah, I mean, basically, for those of you that don't know, you know, which all depends on how long you've been in the hobby. Games Workshop years ago, I think from any time from what 07 and earlier, used to do what are called bits, which basically meant that every single piece that of every model that Games Workshop made was available to you for you to order separately. So let's say. The biggest thing that you'd usually see with this were weapon swaps. So I'm building an Empire army, but oh my god, can you believe how fucking awesome those Howling Banshee swords are for Warhammer 40K?
Yeah.
So I'm going to order a bunch of those swords because they're like, you know, they're nice, they're curved, they're like scimitars, and I really want to do that look, and I'm going to do it up and put it on. And so this was fantastic. This was a hobbyist's, you know, wet dream, was their ability to buy any piece from any model that Games Workshop made.
Well, yeah, I mean, the game is so driven by creativity and personality. I mean, the reason why we paint armies is because that's our personality given form in the armies that were playing there on the table. So, you know, I mean, when I finish painting an army, it's just like, that's my army. I would not be able to go and play the exact same Lizardman army painted by somebody else and enjoy it as much. I mean, you guys bought me that orc army a long time ago, but the reason why I enjoy playing it so fucking much is because I painted more than half of that army and was involved in the conversions and the bits process, and like half the bits that we used to convert the tanks and the vehicles and all that kind of shit was stuff out of my own bits box at home because we were so proud of this army. That's why that army means so much to me. So that's why I loved bits. But Games Workshop,
You know, and that's the thing is like Games Workshop sometime around 2007 basically decided that they were going to completely phase out bits. And so for a period of time of about a year, you couldn't order any bits whatsoever. It was either, you know, you had to buy the complete model. And the worst part about this is there was no advance warning. It was just one of those things where it's just like, yeah, and, you know, yesterday was the last day we'd take bits orders. From now on, nothing. And you're like, wait, what the fuck? You know, and now they've kind of slowly released, you know, bits packs and things like that where they tried to say these are the most common bits.
It's not the same.
No, it's absolutely not the same because, I mean, you know, for example, I had an idea to do a Dorney and Heresy. And if you don't know what it is, just look it up. I'm not going to explain it. Army of Blood Angels, where I was just like, you know, I think it'd be very cool if I modeled every last one of them to have like mutated chaos-y, you know, Nurgle rotty wings. And the carrion kit is perfect for that.
Yes, that's what I used to convert my Nurgle Lord. That's where you got the idea from.
That is absolutely where I got the idea from. I mean, hell, creativity is, you know, stealing shit, right, Hollywood? And, you know, so it's just like, I was just like, ah, that'd be brilliant. And I did up a list and I was just like, okay, I need like 50 sets of wings. And lo and behold, Games Workshop doesn't sell those wings separately. So I can pay $25 per carrion for one wings. Per pair of wings times 50. Fuck you.
And yeah.
Like at the point where it's just like basically Games Workshop is encouraging me to be a criminal because my options are spend thousands of dollars for one piece, which I'm not going to do, or buy one and cast my own and say, fuck them, fuck your money. I'm not going to give you anything because you're a cunt. And that's what it comes down to. And that's why, to me, I think
now,
it
say
is
that
a
again
fail.
With a British accent. You can't do accents, can you?
Not well. Not on the spot, not when I've been drinking.
Or they're or they're telling me spend all this money on one piece. Like you're a fucking cunt. I kind of dribbled into Australian there for a second, but they're all criminals to begin with, so why not?
It's true. You know, and that's what it comes down to, where basically, you know, this is lost revenue for Games Workshop, and that's why it's a failed stupidity check, because even now, 4 years later, because it's 2011, 4 years later, they're still missing the boat on this, because, you know, there are people who are willing to pay the money to get the bits.
Okay. When you and I were working for Games Workshop, and anybody who has worked for Games Workshop during the period of time where bits orders were available and you had the bits catalogs and you had all these things with it, you know that you did not go a day, maybe 2 days, without a bits order going through. Everyone was ordering bits. It was how we hyped armies. It was how we hyped creativity. It was how we hyped painting. We sold a shit ton. And it wasn't because it was this awesome business model. It was just you gave people the freedom to do these things, and you were selling the product that you already had available to you to begin with. We sold so many fucking bits orders. It was like every week when our shipment came in, we had a whole box just for bits orders. Part of that was because we were selling it to them, but part of it was because that opportunity was there and people loved it, right? One of the things that I did recently was Games Workshop here in E-Town was doing a Bits Bazaar where you can bring in your own shit, like your Games Workshop stuff, and sell it to other people in the store, and then they basically give you Games Workshop gift certificates as money to pay for it. I came in with my Bits box, and my Bits box was pretty impressive. I sold more in bits.
You hear that, ladies?
Oh, my Bits box is impressive. Thick, long, and strong. But no, like I sold more just by selling shit out of my bits box than I did out of like I had two full armies to sell worth of shit, like demon, golden demon class painted shit, like models, all sorts of stuff. People weren't interested, but boy, they were sure digging through my bits box like mad because that opportunity just wasn't there anymore. I sold half of my bits box in one sitting because there was just so much stuff for people to get into. And like you say, it's a failed stupidity check because it's not like they're saving money by not doing this. They've just cut out a section of revenue from their company. And I know because I know people who work or who worked as the higher ups in that company and can say, like, it's not like we saved anything by doing this. We just stopped doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, absolutely. And I mean, to your point where you said every single day or every other day we were ringing them through, they used to have that giant catalog that would sit there and fuck, it was
fucking
never
pages
available.
Falling out of it. Like, the, it yeah, was pages so used.
There was always a lineup. Like, people would come in, they're like, oh, I wanted to look at it. So I guess I'll just talk to you guys and check out these codexes while I wait for that guy to finish up. And then as soon as he's done, bam, you pounce. Like, right. It's just like, that book was always being looked at because everybody was always looking at it to get ideas, to get inspiration.
Yeah.
To do their armies because, I mean, everybody wants their shit to be their shit. They want it to be unique to them. And whether that's the way they model it or the paint it. Yeah, you're right. It is that dream army. And it used to be easily available. And now, like I said, failed stupidity check. Games Workshop has basically said they hate money.
Well, Games Workshop hasn't made a good business decision in 3 years, as far as I'm concerned. So this was no surprise for me. And kind of when it ended and they just started taking shit out. I mean, this is akin to their whole idea of, you know, if we just keep taking the bottom 10% of our sales, like models who are in the bottom 10% of our sales, and just take them off the shelves and put them into mail order, it'll be awesome. But like, shit, when I was originally wanting to build my Lizard Men, I wanted a Saurus Lord on Cold One, Games Workshop. Neither of my local Games Workshops had it. So what did I do? I didn't mail order it from them. I waited. It was like 9 months worth of time, and it was a local hobby shop in Seatown, in Cowtown, that I went to, where he was just like, oh yeah, I got that on the shelf, bought it up in a second. Why? Because I don't want to order shit online. I understand if that's my only option, but when I have a local Games Workshop or local hobby shops, they're in my city within driving range with fucking friends that I know who work there, and I want to support my hobby, and I get in there and they're just like, yeah, we just don't carry anything. You go look at the blisters on the wall and there's like two Lizard Man blisters. It's like, you know what? Fuck you. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to go buy this from eBay or Maelstrom or any number of like other websites where I can get it for 15% cheaper with no shipping.
Well, exactly. That was kind of my point. You know, is why would I ever pay? You know, why would I drive all the way to the Games Workshop store just so I can put an order in through their till where I have the options of having it shipped to the store or shipped to my house when either A, I could buy it at discount from any number of other websites online, in which case I'm getting it for cheaper, and B, whether I do that or whether I go on a Games Workshop site in my house, I can at least be naked and I don't have to go the fuck to the store and do it. Like, it's just like, why would I go to your store to do an online order
I can't get what I need in your store?
I can do it on my fucking phone.
No,
why would I go to your store?
And again, it's a business decision that saved them no money. And I can say that with relative confidence because I know people who can tell me that it saved them no money. You know, and I mean, like, GW released their financials to the public recently and they have not been good.
Well, I mean, the last couple of years have been good. This particular quarter was exceptionally bad and it slid harder than they anticipated, which is why they've shook up their release schedule to try to put some hot sellers in before fiscal year end. But I mean,
that's stupid. They're stupid. It's a, you know, I love game. Clearly we love Games Workshop games.
Look, the first rule of when you love something, you marry it and then you go online and you bitch about it. That's
right. Listen,
in that order.
We love the game, but the company is fucking stupid. The people running the company, fucking Kirby is an idiot. I'm sorry. The guy is a fucking moron. I will say it 100 times over because I know the shit that comes down the pipe. But listen, you know, they haven't made a good decision as far as I'm concerned in the last 3 years. They haven't made a proper change to their company to adjust to this new business model. And I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine yesterday, actually. And I know we're running a little bit long here, but shut up, fuck you, what do you care?
But turn it off if you hate it.
Yeah. Oh, if we're taking up your, if you're not too busy, Jesus. No. But you know, we had a very interesting conversation about kind of this whole idea of like Games Workshop slowly abandoning their retail stores, and this like it's a 5-year, 6-year plan of them just basically saying like, we're not going to change the model. We're just going to make as much money as we can. And we're eventually going to transition to an all-online, all-mail-order type game. Because look at every other game distributor out there. I mean, fucking War Machine doesn't have its own stores. Heavy Gear doesn't have its own stores. Firestorm Armada doesn't have its own stores. You know, fucking, Flames of War doesn't have its own stores. And they make money. You know, they make money. I mean, they're not as big. They're not the giant that Games Workshop is. But they don't have the overhead that Games Workshop has. And that is a huge difference because every, you know, Games Workshop knows that if they all of a sudden closed every retail outlet, that it's not like everybody would just suddenly stop playing the game. We just mail order our own shit and create our own community because we're already doing that anyways. I know I just blew your mind, didn't I?
Well, you blew something.
Semen metaphors.
To carry on our running joke of the episode. No, oh, wow. You know, and that's the thing. You know, I can't say I disagree. You know, it's just you look at what they're doing.
That was all speculative, by the way. That was not like I had an inside track on it. The whole Kirby being an idiot is it was right about. That was true.
Look, you don't like truthiness? Get the fuck out.
I am literally out of. I've been out of scotch for the last 10 minutes. So
I've also been out of wine.
Oh, that's true. Well, I think that does signal the end of our episode, though. That has been Jaded Gamercast for this week. My name is Lang.
I am Nathan.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.